Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 45. On this episode, we are talking about Exodus, Gods, and Kings. Joining me on the show is Alan Hawkins from Church of the Redeemer here in Greensboro, and with him is J.R. Forresteros. And for those of you who have been listening to the podcast, you are no stranger to J.R. and the good work he does around the interwebs, and I'm glad to have him back. These two gentlemen help us dive in and then part the Red Sea of truth versus fact in Ridley Scott's adaptation of Exodus. We've seen this movie done a couple times before. Ten Commandments, Prince of Egypt, those are fairly beloved films, and comparing this may be fair, may be unfair, but we'll probably end up doing it just a little bit anyway. In this film, we're going to be talking about choices that were made, especially in reference to child gods. We do get in a couple Bat Moses references, and we do point out that while Ridley Scott may be in denial about his own worldview, it does shine through his work. So we have a great time. We have a lot of good discussion. It's interesting about how this movie does not create the same controversy that Noah has, and we offer up a couple suggestions about why that might have been. So we hope you enjoy it. And here it is, episode 45, Exodus and the Impatient Child. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So, I'm really glad that I have both you guys on to talk about a biblical movie. It's always great to have pastors on in general, because you know, people usually care more about what you say, whether it's deserved or not.
Right.
So we are going to be talking about Exodus, Gods and Kings. But I think one of the biggest things that was interesting to me was the fact that I expected a lot of controversy about this movie. I know that JR, both you and Alan saw a lot of the controversy that came out with Noah, like, should you see it, should you not see it? If you were a pastor, would you tell your parishioners to see this? You know, where do you fall on biblical heresy? And
My favorite thing to do with Noah is to hold a non-Christian filmmaker to obscenely strict Christian standards.
I like you a lot already.
Well, I mean, there's a conversation out there that, like I said, that we'll end up getting to with Exodus here in a second, about where do we hold, or whose fault is this that we don't have good Christians or good Christian filmmakers making good Christian stories? Like, so what do we expect? I mean, should we just not go to these movies? Should we have lower expectations? Should we enjoy them for what they are? Should we just be happy and use them as an evangelical tool that someone else besides probably the people that are mad at these type movies go? Like, how would you use them as a tool?
Well, my personal feelings on it is that one reason why I doubt we'll see what I'd call an evangelical Orthodox Christian make a well-funded Hollywood blockbuster movie that's Christian or Judeo-Christian in content, is that at the essence of the gospel is a stumbling block and an offense. And so even in this movie, the offense was taken out by changing the nature of who God was.
Okay.
So that's why I think it's going to be really hard. I mean, all of us Christians want an Orthodox evangelical believing person to make a movie like this. But the reason they're not going to get funded is if they did make a movie like that, the gospel would have an offensive edge to it. And that's what makes it hard. So, I mean, if they would have really said, how God presented his choosing of Israel. That Israel has been chosen, and God's made a promise to this people, and they're going to be a blessing to the world. And from them, a Messiah is going to come who is going to die for the whole world. And if you don't believe in him, you're not chosen. You know, that's, I mean, Hollywood's not going to fund that.
It's not going to be accessible to the average person?
No. So when you take Noah and you take a movie like this, they're not going to get, I doubt an Orthodox evangelical is ever going to get to make a movie like this through a Hollywood studio that spends hundreds of millions of dollars. That's just my personal opinion. I could be wrong. Often am.
I don't know. I think a big part of the problem is that starting back in, at least the 60s, evangelical Christians started detaching ourselves. Actually, gosh, it goes back further than that. Probably about the same time you could even reasonably speak about any Christians as some kind of evangelical, we were already withdrawing from popular culture and critiquing and condemning popular culture. In my own Nazarene tradition, we had a whole list of things we called special rules that were how you were holy. And they included don't go to the movies and don't dance and don't go to the circus. And they were written in black and white in our manual. And so when you do that, you raise up entire generations of Christians who don't know how to tell stories the world can even understand. And I think that there are some films out there that have some fascinating messages that at least go in the direction of scripture, if they don't commit. And you know, there are filmmakers working in Hollywood even that are Christian screenwriters and directors and stuff like that. So I wonder if the issue is even a little bit deeper than that, and that we don't know how to tell good stories. We've reduced the scriptures to an instruction manual, which, as far as I know, very few people sit around and read in their spare time, when it is, in fact, like a beautiful, complex, complicated, maddening story that you have to wrestle with for your entire life in a community of people who are also committed to that same kind of wrestling. It's not cut and dry. It's not neat. It's frankly not easy to understand. And so we've taken all the beauty out of it and reduced it to this like boring, trite, uninspiring, safe thing. And I wouldn't want to listen. So you get something like the mess of the Kirk Cameron movies of late, or all those where it's not art, it's moving pictures that are preaching it. You know, it's just a sermon dressed up in a little bit fancier clothing. And I don't know, like none of the people. What's that?
Well, I was gonna say with really bad sermon illustrations.
Yeah, right. I mean, come on. Honestly, I don't know. Even if you had a really good sermon illustration, I don't know if the primary point of your film is to teach, if it's didactic instead of provocative, instead of artistic, instead of enticing. I'm not sure that anyone's gonna like it, except the people who already agree with the message.
Well, and that's the things that we've talked about on this show before. And if you, or if I've had a personal conversation with you outside of the show, or even if you go to the site and read the general purpose of the podcast, like we are seeing all kinds of, I don't know, provocative stories being told. And in those stories, something's happening. And we take that akin to Christ as Messiah could have shown up and said, let me just recite, you know, Old Testament law to you, very verbatim. Let me not try to explain it anymore. The word stands for itself. You know, here's the Ten Commandments. But he doesn't. Like, he comes and he tells stories. He tells these things that are divisive, that are, like you said, I like the word you used, JR, provocative. You know, and we have like a very, there's almost like an erotic tone to that in our current culture, but provocative just means that, you know, it's provoking something in you. Like there's a response, like you have to interact with it. And based on his model, I think it's God could have chosen to interact with people any way that he wanted to, and he chose to tell stories. Because I think we were created for story. We were created to respond to story. So I think if we told better stories, it would probably help a lot. Which is why I think JR and I landed... Actually, I think all three of us landed pretty similarly when we saw Noah earlier this year. This 2014 has been called like the year of the Bible movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've had Son of God, we've had Noah, we've had God's Not Dead. I'm sure Kirk Cameron put out two or three films that 10,000 people saw. So this has been like the year of the Bible movie. And unfortunately, I think very few of those stories were told really well. I do think, and like I said, this is where I think we all agree, that Noah was told, it was incredibly provocative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, love it or hate it, Noah was crazy. And right? It said something, and it did something, and it owned it.
Yeah. And so I felt like we all landed pretty similarly on that. And that's the thing. Just like you said, Jared, whether you loved it or hated it, it provoked something. Whereas on the other hand, now, you know, we kind of turn our eyes now, and the reason we're here is to talk about Exodus. And this film, like I said, almost zero controversy that I've really seen. Either we're all controversied out, or as my wife has pointed out, this film is so boring that it's not provocative. Mm. Which is interesting, because I think the Bible, much like with Noah, and Noah is an incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
Death, destruction. It's got almost everything you'd want in a Hollywood epic.
Mm-hmm.
Except it almost pales in comparison to like the journey of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Especially centered around Moses.
Mm.
And somehow it's possible that they've made a movie about one of the most interesting stories ever that just doesn't hold up, that's boring. Like, how do you do that? Or is that just me?
Can I make another suggestion that came up in a conversation I was having with some friends about why maybe Noah generated more controversy?
Yeah, sure.
One of my friends suggested that it might be because Christians hold Noah more sacred than Moses. In that, one, for instance, how many 10 plagues nursery themes have you seen?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Or mm-hmm. I mean even the other parts of the Moses story, right? Whereas like Noah's Ark is the go-to kids church decoration, nursery decoration, kids toy, Bible illustration like thing. But also like I can't help but wonder if, despite how much lip service we give to Moses, we've all been sort of poisoned by Martin Luther's reading of Paul as like a strong anti-law, anti-Jewish sort of reading of the New Testament, so that in some ways for I think a lot of evangelical Christians, Moses's law has become the opposite of the gospel. And and that like Noah just doesn't have that kind of baggage, right? I mean, Noah saved everyone, Moses chained us all to the law.
Huh.
That was my friend's suggestion, and the more I've thought about it, the more I've sort of resonated with it. I don't know what you guys think.
I probably didn't think about that, but I also wasn't a product of growing up in the church where I went to Sunday school and had Noah's Ark themes all over and kind of idealized that. I do think I'm speculating, I'm theorizing, so it might not come across very articulate. But I do think that the agenda of the scriptures is that you would have life and life eternal. And so that's a harder agenda to capture in visual, acting, screenplay, movie sets than it is through textual narratives. So I do think a Christian filmmaker who would try to do that in such an excellent way has his hand tied somewhat. Whereas like the director for this, Ridley Scott, right? If you look at the way he portrayed God, I have to believe there was an agenda in that. And that agenda was okay. It was safe for him to do that. It was his opinion and his thoughts. and he was not necessarily forcing you to agree or buy his agenda that God is this somehow capricious, angry, wrathful, snotty little 11-year-old or 12-year-old, right? So I didn't watch that thinking, I've got to believe that picture about God. But if I'm trying to convey to you the gospel or the truth of Scripture, I'm actually trying to get you to engage with the idea that this is to be believed and received. And that's my hypothesis about why I think it's going to be hard for a believing person to really get to make a great cinematographic, well-acted, well-funded blockbuster movie about a Bible story. I'm beating a dead horse probably by now, but that's just my opinion.
Well, no. So when I do think about any controversy that has come up with Exodus, I think most of it does center around the portrayal of God, because I don't think anyone went into Exodus expecting the story to be verbatim what's in the Old Testament, but it was a shock to see God portrayed as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily think that at first I had a problem with that, even though it wouldn't have been probably in my top five choices of how to portray God. And I figure, I mean, you brought it up, so I figure we might as well go ahead and address it, especially since we're talking about what does create controversy. So God is portrayed as, I guess, roughly probably an 11 or 12-year-old boy.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, like I said, I thought it was interesting, but obviously, I know, Alan, you're in disagreement with, like, the theologically accurate portrayal of that. And
totally wrong. Yeah, but I actually loved it.
So, okay, so go into why you loved it, but, like, why, you know, it was, like, specifically why it was wrong with the way that you saw it portrayed, but why you still maybe liked it.
Okay.
And then with JR, we'll get...
Definitely wrong for the portrayal, number one, because it's not even in the text. You can't read Exodus and find that picture of God manifested that way.
You don't think so?
As an 11-year-old with a British accent.
Egypt. Oh, I was meaning more as temperamental and capricious.
No. I don't think so. And so that, to me, kind of discredits it at face value. But secondly, why I love that is that it revealed an agenda or an interpretation that the director had. And for some reason, he felt led, nudged, whatever, to put that in there. Like, for some reason, he read the Exodus story and he thought, God had to be mad to do this. And God had to be hateful and vindictive to do this. And so I actually love it when people show their true colors. So that's what I appreciated about it. That's the director's true colors. And quite honestly, culturally, that's how a lot of people read the Old Testament story.
Mm-hmm.
Is they think God's really running around this universe just ticked off at people and wanting to hurt them. And so, you know, the culmination for it is where Ramses is holding his child and he's saying, who could worship a God who would do this, right?
Mm-hmm.
He is articulating a skeptic's view of the Scriptures.
Yeah, he's not the first person that said, and he won't be the last.
He won't be the last.
That says, why would a good God allow this to happen, right?
Yeah. So
Not just allow.
Oh, yeah, not just allow.
Did, right? Yeah. I mean, the film makes no bones about that.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, to me, if you want ammunition in your arsenal of video clips to talk about how the skeptic views the story of the Old Testament and possibly even all of Scripture, you got it in two or three video clips. So that's what I guess I would say selfishly, that's what I loved about it. Like, that's a argument worth combating. Like, if that's your picture of God, let me show you the whole big picture and the whole big story, and you'll see that view doesn't stand up when you look at Christ on the cross.
So you're a big fan of pulling back the kind of bull,
yeah,
that people put up, like, oh, well, it's just not for me, da 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 da.
Right.
You want to cut to the heart of why someone doesn't believe, or, you know, and like, let's have a conversation about
exactly.
that. And Ridley Scott basically said, well, this is why
I'm showing my true colors.
Yeah, and okay, I appreciate that. I like when you finally. That's why I like asking people super awkward questions
right.
when you first meet them,
yeah.
Because they're so used to answering, you know, what do you do for a living,
right.
and things like that. You just ask them something really off the wall, and usually they don't have that pre-prepared answer,
right?
And so they kind of inadvertently start showing how they truly feel about things,
exactly.
And then I think you can have really great conversations.
I mean, do you think it was inadvertent?
The portrayal of God the way they did,
yeah.
Oh, no, it was...
Okay, I was going to say, it seemed very, very intentional to me.
I mean, a director is an artist and a philosopher and a thinker. You know, they had to work out, hey, this is why we're going to put this scene in here, and mm-hmm. this is the script, if they wrote it or if they adapted it or whatever, however he got the script for it. So I really, like, watching it, I thought, oh, my gosh, what a great opportunity to answer that question. As a pastor, as a Christian, like, they're saying better than what I could say about how the world thinks about this
yeah.
Old Testament story.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's what I wanted to ask you about too, JR, because to me, I would probably, maybe I'm somewhere in the middle, but I would ultimately agree with what Alan's saying, that I don't think you can read all of the Bible and see God as, you know, a petulant, you know, vengeful, unjust God. But maybe where you're going is, I think you can read pieces of God in the Old Testament out of context, or, you know, not taking a look at the overarching narrative that mm-hmm. is woven.
Yeah, I don't think it's. I mean, it's hard to get away. When a modern reader comes to these ancient texts,
mm-hmm.
it's hard to get away from a very disturbing picture of God. I think if they're read faithfully, the picture of God is very disturbing, as well it should be, because in the same way, many of us who look at the moral codes of many ancient cultures in which these stories about God arose, we find those moral codes very disturbing. And so it shouldn't surprise us that the way that these ancient cultures talked about God would also be disturbing. Hmm. Now, I think when you also then, as a Christian, confess that Jesus is the fullest and most perfect and most sufficient revelation of God, you have to read these other ancient texts through the lens of Jesus. And when you do
exactly.
that, you get all kinds of problems. They're not insolvable problems. And I think they actually take you somewhere really, really beautiful and good and helpful. But we can't just sweep everything under the rug and say, nope, we're good, everyone. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Like, that's in the canon. They have to be taken seriously. And when they're not, I mean, I'm sure you guys, like me, have met many people who have left the faith or never bothered approaching it in the first place because their questions weren't taken seriously. They were mm-hmm. told, just shut up and believe.
Right.
And for someone who's been commanded to love God with all your mind as well as your heart, body, and soul, that's problematic for, you know, so
yeah.
So I like you, Alan. I was glad they went there. I was like, yep, all right, let's put it on the table and talk about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me because I don't think that I've had a, you know, over 3-minute conversation with anybody about Exodus mm-hmm. so far who hasn't come to the conclusion that the portrayal of God specifically and some other choices that were made in Exodus were done, like, they don't believe that they weren't done intentionally. Like, you know, they were like, this was a decision, they obviously did this.
Totally.
And they're obviously trying to,
you know, if God had been something we'd seen before, it would be easier to think like, well, you know, they just did that and were focusing on other parts of the film. But we've never seen God portrayed like this before. So it was obviously like on purpose, you know.
So I've been reading, just so I don't sound like an idiot when I got on here. I've been reading reviews of it, and I would actually rather critique the reviews than the movie itself, because the reviews, and especially the more I would call conservative evangelical you get, the more it's like, here's the review. Okay, Exodus, blah, 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 a little boring in some parts, you know, great cinematography, yada, yada, yada. But they did a disservice to the character of God. I wouldn't go see this. It's not worth your money. And honestly,
right.
honestly, those make me mad, because I'm like, you're missing an opportunity culturally.
Yep.
To talk about the character and the nature of God through this narrative. And so you're telling people, don't use your mind and don't be able to winsomely and persuasively tell the truth of the gospel and the story of God using a movie like this. It's almost like, run away from it. It's taboo. Get out. Don't do it, because it's awful. And they portrayed God. So God's, he's not going to be diminished by this movie.
Well, so I had the fortune, I do this fairly often, to be on the Movie Bite podcast, and we just reviewed Exodus earlier this week, and we were talking about, I mean, it's not, you know, a Christian theology podcast, it's mostly just a, you know, a popcorn movie review podcast, so we're not really getting into things too deep, but we are, we were all Christians, and so it came up. We're talking about the portrayal of God. Was it, you know, additive or subtractive from the film? And ultimately, I just was like, look, I don't think God's up in heaven mad that like he was portrayed. He's like, oh, you know, palm to forehead,
right.
You know, like that Ridley Scott portrayed him, you know, like I understand that he would have probably preferred it, you know, someone actually engaging and telling the true story of the gospel. Yeah. But, you know, like I don't think he's going to come and be revengeful about right. like him being portrayed like that. And I love the opportunity that we have like this to
exactly.
talk about it and
exactly.
to engage culture, which goes back to kind of what JR was saying at the beginning of the podcast about, you know, the church having a pretty solid history for decades now. Running from culture.
Yeah.
And separating ourselves with the castle mentality.
Yeah.
You know, like the, this is good, all these things are bad,
yeah.
we'll get together, we'll sing some songs, pray that you don't get dragged out of the castle, and we'll go to heaven at some point.
Right.
And I think that that's the, basically the tone of most of the reviews that I've seen.
Absolutely.
Or they basically say, here's my review. This happened. Didn't really happen in the Bible. This happened.
Right.
Didn't really happen in the Bible.
Right, right.
I was like, this isn't a review.
That's the best you got?
I was like,
right.
you know,
yeah.
you're not even engaging. There was a really great review out there called Everything You Need to Know About Exodus.
Yeah.
I think it was over at Norval Rogers. written by some jerk named JR. You know, you know, that I thought it did, you know, I thought it was even kill. It was like, look, these are things that this did well. These are things that I don't think that did very well.
Yeah.
But ultimately, people are going to go see it. So let's talk about it.
Right. So, again, this could sound really bad, but...
But you're excited, so it's okay.
I'm excited, and I'm sitting forward, so my body language is saying I'm geared up to talk about this. Okay, so our country is embroiled in discussions about racism, primarily white and African American, that stem from an awful, evil history of slavery. And so everyone is in up in arms
mm-hmm.
about it. It's just the hot button of the day, right? Okay. So if you're watching Exodus and you're seeing a culture that for hundreds of years enslaved another people group and progressively became more tyrannical and more awful, then of Ramsay sitting there holding his baby for being the dictator of this regime, who's questioning how a God could kind of slap back and say, no, don't do that to people. Like, I doubt anyone was offended by watching the slavery scenes of Israel under Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the whole idea of justice and how if you're communicating the truth of this story and taking the opportunity about it to say, Moses went to Ramses on multiple occasions and said, stop, let my people go. You know, so this whole view that Ridley Scott gives of God being this angry, tyrant, capricious little person is just so far off from the actual biblical story.
Mm-hmm.
That it is such an opportunity for us to say, look how this is presented. Let's really talk about what was happening. And let's really put God under the microscope. Was he capricious, tyrannical, evil? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I probably didn't sound very articulate.
No, I totally get what you're saying. And I think that actually that, like what you were just calling for was the film's biggest misstep.
Exactly.
I was talking with one of my buddies about it, and he said I felt like let me ask this before I tell you what I was thinking. What was the most emotional poignant moment for you in the film?
Was there one?
Oh, that's, and now you're asking Mikey's question that he's supposed to ask at the end.
No, I'm not saying your favorite moment or your least favorite.
Okay.
I'm saying the moment that most, it has to be the death of the first one.
Like something that you, yeah. What emotionally did you connect with?
Yeah, I would say that was definitely really hard.
Okay.
To hear the screams, to hear them hearing the cries.
When that white horse that had no rider and had no point being in the middle of the Red Sea was killed by that wave.
Okay,
I was a little scared.
Other than Mikey and PETA, everyone else.
Mikey just tried to win points with PETA.
The people, I mean, so the problem with the film is that God and Moses were the bad guys.
Yeah.
And you felt the most sympathy for the Egyptians.
Exactly.
And that is like the exact opposite of the point of the story in the scriptures.
Totally.
That's the exact opposite of the role that the story of the Exodus has played in Western civilization throughout history. It's always been a call for liberation against the oppressors.
Right.
And this film somehow, on accident, I think,
reversed
that. Like, it got it wrong.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
And so if you want to talk about racism and the just deplorable history of slavery in this country, this is actually a great story to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God actually hates slavery.
What are you talking about? I've read the Bible. It says, you know, serve your masters.
No, it's not. He's never endorsing taking mm-hmm. slaves. But he's also qualifying how you are to treat people who are under you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, that's the, to me, the opportunities with this movie are enormous culturally
mm-hmm.
right now, I think.
You mean that God doesn't ever endorse slavery because the times he's committing genocide, right?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
You said God never endorses slavery because he's usually commanding the genocide, right?
Like, yeah, just
don't
wipe
take
them
as slaves because kill them all.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes. So, you know, like how he delivers Israel from slavery and how he hears their cries. And how he calls out a nation that's doing this, almost saying to it, repent, stop, mm-hmm. let my people go, I agree with you, JR. It was a big misstep. We made the Egyptians heroes.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting that you put it that way, too, because I remember having a conversation before I was a Christian. You know, I had all these problems with God and mm-hmm. who God was and how God did things. And I didn't always have, you know, thoughtful people there to give me the answers.
Mm.
And so I had an identical conversation before and after I became a Christian. Before, I said, you know, how does God kill all the firstborn? They're babies.
Right.
Right? Like, what kind of a-hole would do that?
Right.
Whether he's a deity or not. And before I was a Christian, the answers to that were, well, God's God and he can do what he wants,
mm-hmm.
which is not untrue,
right?
But it, I don't think is a very.
It's also deeply disturbing.
Yes, it's exactly. It's not a very helpful answer, and it doesn't, you know, doesn't, I don't think, give you an idea as the heart of God, the intentions of God, or the character of God.
Right.
So after, you know, it's like, well, if you think about it, much like he does with almost every other character in the Bible, God gives the Egyptians, who, at, you know, the way it's read, he has no real ties to, like 10 chances or 9 chances, mm-hmm. you know, and he sends a dude who's what his brother tells him to,
right?
Like, here's what we need you to do. So it's not like he just showed up one day and was like, everyone's dead.
Yeah.
He was like, look, stop, right. Stop.
Exactly.
Stop.
Well, and we need to understand the thing we need to understand about the plagues, and the movie kind of did. Okay, here's my other problem. I felt like the movie was made by people who understood ancient Near Eastern culture, but it was shown to a bunch of people who didn't understand ancient Near
Eastern culture. Totally, yeah. Yeah.
So, for instance, every single plague was an attack, a direct specific attack on an Egyptian deity.
Exactly.
And it was basically a demonstration of Yahweh's superiority over the Egyptian deities. Mm-hmm. And so here's something that I've always thought I'm calling dibs on it right now, everyone who's listening, because no one's ever written this into the story, but I think it's interesting. When it said the death of the firstborn, we always assume it's all babies, but that's not true. Like, the firstborn is the oldest, the second oldest, or, well, it's the father's oldest living male child.
Child, right?
So if the father, so for instance, I imagine telling a story sometime where you still have Moses and Ramesses are brothers, or whatever, raised as brothers. You know, you saw that sibling relationship, but Ramesses' father is still alive and still a pharaoh. Right. And so Ramesses would be the one who would die. Exactly. Because the whole point of the death of the firstborn is that since Pharaoh saw himself as a god, he is able to maintain and protect his own house. Mm-hmm. And causing the deaths of the firstborn shows that Pharaoh can't keep you safe, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do that in the film. So again, it turns it, instead of it being this like attack on the systemic cancers of the Egyptian culture, it turns into like this, yeah, this like vengeful bratty deity, like mm-hmm. killing babies.
Right.
You know?
Well, and that's part of the thing about the plagues, that it was a love-hate thing for me, because actually, I mean, not to give you too big of a head, JR, but I really like this the way that you put it in your Things to Know article, because you said that like he puts the miracles on the line between natural and supernatural,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
and then slightly shifts the scale to the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the fact that there's not really any bones made about this. God has his hand in this.
Yeah.
This is supernatural. I mean, it might happen through a semi-natural means,
right.
or a natural progression, but there is something supernatural, something otherworldly pushing these events.
It's clear in that movie, right? Like,
yeah,
there's no,
exactly.
I didn't feel like it was vague at all. But yeah, there is definitely a God doing these things.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And especially by the time you get to the death of the firstborn,
right? Exactly.
Right.
It's obvious that if you argued at one point, then you can't really argue against that. So the love part is that we do have a movie that's made by someone I'm assuming does not prescribe to.
He's
the
a self-proclaimed atheist, as far as I know. Yeah.
So, Ridley Scott is.
Yeah.
So we have someone with that belief system who is making a movie saying that this thing happens, which I think is pretty remarkable.
It is.
And I
want to
be like, thumbs up.
Props.
Yeah. But at the same time, basically this is what I think you hit on great, JR, is that it still misses the entire point.
Why do you keep giving JR credit? Like,
well,
you keep
he wrote
saying
a review.
JR is this, JR this.
I've got
like,
in my notes
what am
here.
I, chopped liver?
I'm gonna reference the
totally
review that
kidding.
Alan has
I'm
about this. So, you know, but you're missing, you know, the Ridley Scott misses the entire point.
Yeah.
You know, there are specific plagues that attack specific things, and the audience never knows it, which is what you were saying, Alan.
Right.
You know, so There's your props.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I mean, so like, you know, so thank you. Thank you. I wanted to really like the plagues, but ultimately there was the subtext of you got it right for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
And I mean, almost right. Like there was all the stuff with the priestess. Like mm-hmm. it was all like so right. Like I left the theater being like, gosh, I spent the whole movie being like, yes. No.
Well, so I want to say this too. And one of the articles I linked and one of the ones I'll put in the show notes talks about it. Ridley Scott was asked, like, how long was the first cut? And he said it was about 4.5 hours long.
Wow.
And I was like,
and the one that worked was 4 hours.
Yeah. And he said the one that worked was 4 hours.
Yeah.
So,
and will they ever release that?
Well, they asked him and he's like, well, there'll be like 25 minutes of deleted scenes. But that's the thing. Ridley Scott has a history of having director's cut of Blade Runner. Yeah. That's apparently the one to watch. Director's okay. cut of Kingdom of Heaven, which takes a movie that lots of people didn't really like to this movie that people were like, what?
Wow.
This is groundbreaking, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was hoping, like the first thing I thought when I left this movie was, I hope I would watch.
It wasn't long enough, yeah, in my opinion.
I was like, it felt like it would never end. Yeah. But if all, you know, if the extra hour and a half that wasn't in this movie would, you know, flesh out the plagues,
yeah,
or flesh out, you know, the real reasons why Ramses suddenly became kind of a, I can't think of a word that's not an inappropriate word.
A bad dude. Yeah.
You know, because like he was indifferent, but then he just became mean.
Yeah.
Or we get a great scene towards the end of the movie with God and Moses, where it's like they've come to some kind of understanding, but I have no idea how they got there based on the previous conversations right. that they've been yeah. having.
A lot left out.
And so I felt like there was a lot that I missed. And not to mention that there were lots of people in this movie that are fairly famous that just kind of like walked on the screen and then walked right off.
Oh, yeah. Sigourney Weaver.
Yeah. I'm like, why did you need, you know, you could have literally picked
Ridley
up.
Ridley Scott likes her, though.
Well, I know he does. But why did you need her in that role?
Yeah.
Is there a lot more to Sigourney Weaver's character? God, what was her character's name? I have it written down. Tuya.
Mrs. Farrow.
You know, why was she cast as that when she was barely there? Why was it billed that Aaron Paul was in this movie
mm-hmm.
when he just kind of was like, what's
uh-huh.
up? What's yeah. up, Moses?
Moses.
And then left. You know, yeah. like Joshua. they never
no
have
character development. Yeah,
I mean, like Joshua should be a big deal
yeah.
in this story. Because you know, this should have been the story of Israel.
Yeah.
That just happened to be centered around Moses.
Right.
But, I mean, I think we've all mentioned this at this point. You know, I feel like he missed the mark.
Yeah, he did. Definitely.
So,
And when Morgan Freeman was played by Sir Ben Kingsley?
That's right. Or Nun. Son of Nun. Son of Nun is, like, one of my favorite things
that
in the
is.
World. Just because
Son of Nun.
Son of Nun.
Nuns are supposed to be celibate.
Like, that's right.
Gosh, well, actually, so that was one of the funniest articles that I read. That Christ in Pop Culture did this really cool thing, where they were asking, do people not enjoy this movie? I mean, because honestly, this movie is, I think it's, last time I checked, it was sitting somewhere between 20% and 25% at Rotten Tomatoes. You know, not that Rotten Tomatoes is the end all be all, but it usually gives you a pretty accurate description of what most people think when they leave the theater, and so it's not getting really many positive reviews. I mean, we've all seen it now. None of us have had glowing reviews of it. And like I said, we all were big fans of Noah. Noah, to me, is one of the best movies I've mm-hmm. seen all year.
Yeah, I really like Noah.
And so it's not like we have a problem with biblical adaptations that aren't strictly adherent to the text.
Right.
Thank God.
Because, we can't expect them to be.
Yeah, we can't expect them to be.
Why would you expect them to be?
But there's something about this movie. There's something about taking one of the most interesting stories ever told or written down and making it boring to some degree. So
that's, you know, my problem with it is I didn't hate the movie, and I would have preferred a movie that I either loved or hated.
Yeah.
But like, indifference is the biggest crime when you're tackling the excellence.
Exactly.
And, you know, I also think a director has to really like the story to make it compelling. And I have a feeling, if he was sitting here, I'd ask Ridley Scott.
I mean, if you're out there, Ridley, and you're listening to this, and you want to come on and talk to us.
Mr. Scott, we're big fans. We'd be honored to have you on the show.
Do you like this story? I have a feeling he would say no.
Well, and that's the thing.
I don't like this story.
Because there are lots of interviews out there. I linked a couple of them in the pre-show notes, and I was going back through them today, and I was looking at Ridley Scott, and honestly, usually he's sitting there talking with or answering questions with Christian Bale, and Christian Bale seems like he's really interested in this story. And I don't know if he's acting, you know, like he likes the story to promote the movie or not, but, you know, Ridley Scott just kind of seemed like he was there, and he was like, this story, I guess, needed to be told. So I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
And I got a paycheck. I'm going to go on to make Prometheus
right.
too.
Yeah.
Whereas on the other hand, Christian Bale, like, he was talking about reading the Torah and always questioning why like Ridley Scott was like, why is this scene not in there? You have to understand this thing in the text, you're not putting this in the movie, and it's super important. And I felt like, if nothing else, maybe he wasn't as passionate about it, but at least getting into character, Christian Bale understood Moses probably better than a lot of Christians do.
Yeah.
And I think that showed I think that showed in his performance.
Yeah.
JR.
Well, yeah, first of all, back on Ridley Scott, I hate to keep comparing this movie to Noah. But, you know, Aronofsky is on record, raised Jewish. Noah's his favorite story in the scriptures.
Yep.
And so you have this professional storyteller who finally gets to tell his favorite story ever, and it shows.
Yeah.
And he wanted to tell Noah for, like, ever.
Right. Right. And he finally and we got a fantastic film. I didn't get the sense. I would love to know why Scott wanted to make Moses. Is it because he saw Prince of Egypt, got the Ramesses Moses brothers idea, and was like, he goes on record as saying that's kind of a big thing because his brother Tony Scott committed suicide a couple years ago, right?
Yeah, so he dedicated it for.
Right, so it was like, is that it? Like, is it just like he wanted to make a movie about brothers, and Cain and Abel was too close to Noah? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what the deal was, but I didn't get the sense that it was a passion project the way Aronofsky's Noah was.
And you know, like. Take the movie Gladiator, right?
Right.
What a great story,
right.
Even though it's actually historically false.
False is probably an understatement, yeah.
I mean, okay, awesome story from the movie. Like, how many times will you watch Gladiator?
Right.
I'll watch whenever it comes on TNT.
I got to go watch it real quick, guys. I'm out.
BRB.
But I'm not going to watch Exodus again.
Right.
If I can help it.
Yeah. I'm just not going to give 2.5 hours to this movie.
Unless there's a director's cut.
If there's a four-hour director's cut, I'm in.
I'm in. But so I think that, you know, again, the story, the compelling story, if he would have loved this story, this movie would have been different, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Whether he agreed with the narrative or
not. Right.
He would have still changed it, but still.
Right. We would have seen that. I think that passion would have come through.
Yeah.
Now, I think it does come through, as you were saying, Mikey, with Bale's Moses. I was fascinated when he was on record in an interview saying that he thought Moses was perhaps schizophrenic. And I couldn't help but, again, I keep doing this, but like both of the big biblical epics that came out this year that were not made by Christians presented the guys who talked to God as a little bit crazy. And I thought that was interesting because normally we would, I think in the church, put these guys up on some kind of a spiritual pedestal. And yet the way most of us treat people who claim to talk to God is as though they're crazy.
Right.
And I loved that actually, because if someone came up to me in my church and they were like, God told me this crazy thing, my first response would be like, I don't think that's true.
Like, unless, of course, he was like, God told me to give you lots of cash.
Right. Well, right. If it was Bill Gates, I'd be like, okay. If it was someone who can't make their house payment, I'd be like, let's have a conversation about this, right?
Right.
Like, I appreciate your enthusiasm, but, you know, so all of that to say, I totally loved it. That was, you know, a lot of people were all upset of it. He said that Moses was schizophrenic and blah, blah, blah. I, I totally loved it. I thought it was a cool way to play Moses. I was fascinated by the before Moses or before Burning Bush and after Burning Bush Moseses. What did you guys think of that?
I don't know. That didn't intrigue me as much as the Joshua coming upon him and watching him arguing with an
with
invisible. Yeah, and how he had to think this guy's loony, right? You know, I thought that was fascinating. But I also think the dialogue with Moses and God, which, again, I would say wouldn't have been the best biblical representation with an 11-year-old kid. I thought it was fascinating because I don't think it's something we even think about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how did Moses talk with God?
Yeah,
what
sure.
did that look like? I have a feeling if you were watching it, it looked exactly like what Joshua saw.
Well, because even the scriptures tell us, right? Moses talked to God as one man talks to another face to face, and that's not how anyone else talked to God.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a great point.
So, you know, you're sitting in your car and you're praying out loud, and the person in the lane looks over at you and they see that you're talking to yourself, and they inherently have to think you're either singing a song or you're crazy.
Yep.
You know, so I did love that part.
Yeah, me too.
I did see Baal portray two specific Noahs. Mm-hmm. I mean, Noah's. Yeah. Oh my gosh, Moses.
Yeah,
Mosai. Like, you know, there was it was interesting. Moisey. It was interesting to see him be a confident
agnostic.
Yeah, basically agnostic
right. warrior.
Yeah, you know, like, hey, you know, stuff's not perfect, but this is what we got to do. There's some people I care about. I'll do whatever. You know, this is what life is.
Yeah.
And I'm cool with that, and it's probably not going to change, but it could be worse.
Right.
Like that, you know, that's how I saw him. And then definitely, like, you know, he had his come to Burning Bush moment, and he changed.
Yeah.
His mannerisms changed. Obviously, like, he physically looked different. You know, mm-hmm. he became, like, ragged and
older
worn.
Moses.
Yeah. And I said I thought his temperament changed appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I think Baal brought that to life was commendable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I mean, because, like I said, like, one of the things that was critiqued about, like, are we upset at Exodus or at this interpretation because we're comparing it to what we saw in the Bible, or are we comparing it to what we're almost taking as canon, which is some combination of the Ten Commandments and the Prince of Egypt. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, Christ and Pop's Culture even had this really great thing. He's like, well, let's have a little exercise. True or false? In the biblical book of Exodus, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
You know, and almost everything that we think happened in Exodus
actually
happened in, like, the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so same thing with a portrayal of Moses. You know, Charlton Heston is Charlton Heston before the burning bush, and then he's Charlton Heston with a big beard
mm-hmm.
after the, you know, like, that's the only change.
Right.
He's still Charlton Heston, you know, like, like very, yes, you know?
Right.
There's almost no. It's like, oh, okay, I'm doing this now with my life.
Yeah, it
okay.
was like this was a normal, inevitable progression of Moses, rather than like clearly a life altering, trajectory shaping.
Yeah.
Like
his worldview had been rocked,
right?
Yeah.
Like, and he did not want to believe it, but the more and more like he, I guess, would try to fight against it, the less he could deny.
Yeah.
And that's what I liked about the very few pieces of Joshua we got, because it seemed obvious that Joshua could have been in the same place.
Right, right.
You know, Joshua could have been like, this dude's crazy. But then, like, Moses said something, and it happened.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, how many times, like, if he's going to talk to an invisible person and they're going to deliver,
Yeah,
like, it's working.
Let's just ride this out and see how far it takes.
You know,
us.
And I mean, because, like I said, for all its flaws, there's still like a scene that actually did stick with me is like when they get to the Red Sea, and they're kind of like, "What now, Moses?"
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
And like the, I think if Joshua hadn't seen all the things that he'd seen, like he would have been like, oh, you know, we're boned.
Yeah.
But
well, and actually I would have been fine with, cause we, you know, in the scriptures, they're upset.
Yeah.
Right? They're like, what are we supposed to do? And Moses is like, God will come through. And you can only imagine. He's like, I'm pretty sure, you know, like,
well, that's what happens. Yeah, well, I was going to say, that's what happens now, right?
Right.
We're like, I can't pay my house payment. You know, you're asking me to still tithe to the church.
Right.
What am I supposed to do? Oh, well, God will provide.
Yeah.
And we don't believe that for a second, right?
Right.
I mean, like, we want to.
Yeah.
But usually people in that situation will, you know, I thought about this going through and preparing for a devotional recently, and I realized, like, the Old Testament makes so much more sense when I realize that I'm Israel mm-hmm. in most of these cases.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really easy for me to be like, gosh, of course he's going to part the Red Sea. But if I'm there in that moment, much like I am when I can't pay my bills or,
we're
you know,
toast.
Yeah, I'm yeah. like, I completely understand suddenly, like, this is me doubting that, you know, yeah. like, we're going to have to swim across the Red Sea to get away from Pharaoh.
Yeah, and, you know, you almost, like, I almost felt sorry for Moses when he was in the wagon with the ark.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
Well, just the picture of he's all alone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's leading all these people, but he's all alone. Which, if you've led people, it is very easy to feel at times all alone.
Yeah.
Not pastors, of course.
Yeah.
But other
yeah.
people.
I mean, but you know, so leadership, leadership in some respects is schizophrenia, because you want to be strong, you want to believe, at the same time there's the brokenness of people and the criticism and the challenge of leading and the challenge of being responsible for others. And so I like that at the end. I really could identify with Moses, like, yeah, he's all alone in this, you know. Hmm. And all these people are riding with him and they're all following him. And he's seeing them at their best and worst. But he looks out and there's, you know, the 11-year-old God kind of looking at him like, you're okay. That was redemption of that.
Not fully fleshed out redemption. Could possibly see a better understanding of his aloneness and a four-hour
right.
cut.
We've got to have the four-hour cut.
Well, I think we've had a pretty good discussion thus far.
Sweet.
But just because this might take a minute, I don't want to delay getting to some of the wrap-up of the show. Because I have a feeling, even though I didn't get to ask the question at the beginning of, you know, did you like this movie? I think our thoughts on the film have come out fairly clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But we are still going to get our chance to roll our eyes metaphorically. And, I mean, heck, you know, J.R., Alan, if you'd like to roll your eyes, you can actually do it. The listeners may just not see it. Unless you roll your eyes very, very well. then it'll come through. But what were some of the moments in this movie that would be categorized as come-on moments to you? Like, I mean, just like, obviously the movie was a little slow. Obviously we felt they made one of the most interesting stories in the world kind of boring. But what really pushed it over the edge?
For me, the killing of the guards. That's the best you got kind of moment. You know, what would have, I mean, why did they have to do it that way when they full know well that that was not accurate to the text? You know, an Egyptian was mistreating an Israelite slave and Moses saw it, pierced his heart. He killed the guy, right? So why did they have to do that? I get the whole rewrite God as an 11-year-old. You know, I can tolerate that a whole lot more than just blatantly disregarding the text. You know?
It would have, and hypothetically, since one of the biggest conflicts in this movie is Moses trying to figure out where he belongs.
Exactly.
Right.
That would have been a pretty great segue
awesome.
Into that
yeah.
that conflict.
They could have used that time for a scene and accomplished actually really bridging Moses away from his Egyptian family to his Israelite family.
Hmm.
So That was the oh come on moment for me.
Okay, so JR, what was it, if not multiple things?
There were a couple things. Similar to what Alan just said, when Zipporah and their son did not return with him, they cut the scene where God tries to kill Moses because his son isn't circumcised, which is one of the like weirdest little stories in the Bible mm-hmm. that no one ever talks about. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that like the whole reason that text is in there is because it shows that Moses was still on the fence, right? Mm-hmm. Like he hadn't circumcised his son. He hadn't fully embraced his identity as a Hebrew, and he could not return to Egypt to battle for the Hebrew freedom if he was uncommitted.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was too bad. Now, again, I got narratively why they did that, so that he could come back and say, these are my people, and blah, 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 whatever. But that's such a weird little story, and it could have been, especially with God as this little, like, 11-year-old kid, it would have been such, like, a crazy scene. Mm-hmm. And it would have fed into Moses' character arc.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, it could have worked. It could have been in there. And so I was just, like, really bummed that it wasn't.
Well, I was going to say, I bet so few people are familiar with that
right.
piece of the story.
The end of they're Exodus not. 4, everyone. Go read it.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. They're not.
So that could have been the equivalent of, you know, like going to see a Marvel movie, and there's always things in the movie that if you read the comics are like nods to the
right.
fact that, you know the original text,
right.
but they totally skip this moment that. To like be like, wink and a nod to everyone who
Aronofsky like, would have done it. I'm just saying.
Hypothetically.
So yeah, that was one of them. The other one was I was just really disappointed with how, and again, maybe in the 4-hour cut this is different, but the Ten Commandments and the Golden Calf got such a short shrift.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Golden Calf scene amounts to, you see it in the distance at the foot of the mountain, and God is like pouty, and Moses is like, these guys, right? Am I right? Like, it was like that kind of look.
Yeah.
And that was it. And then it cut to them, like, drinking tea and him, like, carving the tablets.
Yeah. Right.
Well, that was one of the scenes that, I mean, I was looking forward to the Red Sea scene a lot because, you know, special effects.
See how they do it.
Do you mean the Red Tsunami?
The Red Tsunami. Well, I mean, just whatever they were going to do with that.
Yeah.
Whatever they're going to do with that, I was looking forward to it. The other thing, I was like, well, if they're going to go that far, because I don't know where they're going to cut the movie off at.
Right.
I don't know what part, you know, anyway. I remember vividly, like, the scene from the Ten Commandments of, like, the terrible shaky cam special mm-hmm. effects of, like, you know, Moses throwing the tablets down and the calf catching on fire or whatever and
right.
people falling into the earthquake holes, you know? I was like, imagine that with special effects.
Yeah.
And but, you know, to do that, Aaron would have had to have a much bigger role than he did, right? He was such a minor character.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do enough with gods for that scene to even make sense.
Right.
I
think they should have put Mel Brooks in there when he History of the World Part 1 comes down. I bring 15. She drops one of them. 10 commandments. Yeah.
Oh, God, that's one of my favorite. Before I was a Christian, that's what I used to always joke about all the time.
Mel Brooks.
Yeah, that scene's so funny.
It is awesome.
So is there anything else, JR, that you need to...
I'm content with those two.
Okay, so... Oh, my gosh. I mentioned it earlier because it was so ridiculous. So it was hyperbole earlier, but like I'm really going to gripe about it now. I don't understand basically the shots that we got from the Red Tsunami coming back in. Like, why did we have a shot of a riderless horse randomly running and getting swallowed by a wave? It seems so random.
Symbolism, dude. People without leadership are swallowed up.
Oh gosh,
chaos!
And then, just the nonsensicalness of Ramses and Moses' showdown in front of the big wave, and like everyone drowns, but somehow they don't.
Yeah.
Like I just like that whole thing was unnecessary to me. That.
Well, but see, again, narratively, I got it because that was Moses left his sword in the sea, right? And that was like his last link.
Tie.
Yeah. Right? And so, and I mean, this is the part, this is one of the things that really bothered me about the whole movie. And, you know, in the scriptures, the Red Sea is always, for Christians, is prefiguring baptism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the waters of the Red Sea are the waters of baptism. Mm-hmm. And in this film, which doesn't seem to give two craps about Israel and only cares about Moses, it becomes Moses' baptism. And so yeah. Moses is the one who dies and is reborn as a Hebrew instead of as an Egyptian. So I got it. I was just like, come on, like, so
yeah, I thought of that too. Almost like the end of Gravity, where Sandra Bullock crawls out of the ocean.
I wept at that scene. I did not weep when Moses came out of the scene.
Yeah.
Well, the whole sword thing, like, I would say that I understood the sword thing, but for some reason, I was really bothered all movie that Moses didn't have his staff.
Yeah. Another omission.
He intentionally leaves it with his son, right? Like, it wasn't an oversight. Like, that was another clear narratival change that I didn't quite understand.
Why would they, like, why couldn't you have him kill an Egyptian slave beater? Why did you have to have him?
So, So, I mean, like, I for some reason, Moses, and, like, I know this, to me, is... Well, I mean, there's scripture that is pretty important for him having a staff. But for me, I know lots of it comes from the visuals that I got in the Ten Commandments. Like, I actually asked myself, I think out loud, when I watched this movie, I was like, how is he going to part the sea with a sword? Like, I was like, is somebody going to come and bring him a staff real quick so he can, like, do big arms? And big arms.
No,
like...
I mean, it's, listen, in Exodus, there's a fascinating linguistic thing that happens at the burning bush, which is up until that point, it's called Moses' staff. And then after the burning bush, after God has him throw it on the ground, it turns into a snake and all that kind of stuff. From that moment forward, when Moses is headed back to Egypt, it's always called the rod of God.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very intentional narrative device to say that, no, this is now... Like, this is sort of a symbol of God's
instrument.
Presence.
Moses.
Yeah. I mean, it's a thing. It's not just from the Ten Commandments.
It is from Exodus.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, I know that, like, he should have one because the Bible says he should have, or the Old Testament says he should have one.
Right.
But visually, I'm like, I'm expecting this scene to happen, and I don't think it can happen. Unfortunately, not because I'm so familiar with the text, but because I see Charlton Heston doing big arms.
Right. You got a tsunami instead. It's okay.
So I mean, for some reason, I wish that wasn't such a big deal to me.
Mm.
You know, and all the things that people were probably going to say, like, this is so blasphemous, or da da da, or this wasn't to the text. The staff was the big deal.
Yeah.
But so was there really anything? That you could say is your favorite moment, like what would that be?
Ramses.
Go ahead, JR.
Ramses.
Yeah.
I love Joel Edgerton, and that monologue that got into the trailer several times, where he's "I am the God," and then he says, "Let's see who's better." So he's talking to Moses, right? But Moses isn't there, and I was just really struck because again. This is one of those points where I was like, yes. When he says, "I'm going to kill every child in every Hebrew child. Let's just see who's better at killing, your God or mine, or me." And then God kills all the Egyptian children.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Ramses is standing in front of Moses holding his child, and he says, "This is the kind of God you worship," he's completely oblivious to the fact that he's describing himself.
Yeah,
you know, like, completely. He doesn't even put it together, and that's why Egypt suffered the plagues, right? Because they can't see that the way that they live is unjust. They can't see that their luxury and their privilege is built on the backs of slaves, and so that's why they can't turn away from it, because they're blind to it. Mm-hmm. And the movie, like, so almost did it, and this is one of those places where, like, yes. But again, instead of it feeling like, well, what do you expect, man? That's what you get. You're like, oh, poor guys. Like, oh, man. You know?
Yeah.
And that's just like, oh, it was so close.
And Christian Bale's response really was a letdown. Like, none of the Israelites died.
Oh, you were let down? I was like, oh, that's ice cold, dude. I was like, gosh.
It sucks to be you guys.
Yeah. Well, he was like, wanted to make it real clear. Like, this wasn't, you can't deny this, Ramses. Like, this was an act of our God.
Well, and I think I'd probably fall in the middle because, like, I was like, that's such a great line, but there needs to be more.
Yeah.
They need to follow it up with something, or they need to have given us more.
It left a lot to be desired.
Yeah.
I loved it. I was like, gah! But anyway, like, Ramses was my favorite part of the film by a long shot. And I thought, even though he was, like, crazy white, like, so super white, Joel Edgerton just did an awesome job. I first saw him in Warrior, and I hope he gets lots more votes.
Yeah, he's going to win something for this. I too loved him. I loved that I was able to look at him and believe he was Ramses.
Yeah.
But I looked at Christian Bale and I thought, why is Batman? You know, so I mean,
let my people go,
and that's that's because of
let them go for me.
Let them go.
you know, I could believe Joel's character much more, and I didn't see Joel in it. I saw Ramses. So yeah,
is that because of all the bronzing?
The bronzing definitely. I think that again, we talked about it earlier. I really liked Moses sitting in the chair, the wagon, covered up, rushing 600,000 Jewish warriors onto the plains of Moab. You know, I just, that was cool. That was my favorite part of the movie. Something like, we won. God's with us. And you couldn't deny that. Skeptic or not, you couldn't deny they got out. They won. Mm-hmm. Which would have been the unlikeliest scenario in that time for that to happen.
Yeah.
You know, Egypt's military might was so decisive and great that they could have swatted away Israel. Yeah. So in that sense, God was vindicated to me.
Right. Yeah.
Through the movie.
Fair enough. Gosh, what did I like about this movie? Well, I guess it goes back to almost everything that I really liked about this movie was almost a love-hate type thing.
Yeah.
I would see something that I was like, yes, I guess similar to what you're saying, JR, like, yes, yes, yes. And then you're like, oh, but you still kind of miss the point or something like that. And I think ultimately I land on this film, much like Alan's mentioned a couple times, like this is a great opportunity to say, you want to actually know the story of this or what this is pointing to?
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you about Israel. Let me tell you about what God thinks about slavery. Like, let's go really look at this story. And its ability to open the doors for cultural engagement. But there were a couple things that I was surprised, and I mentioned this earlier, that I think I enjoyed the plagues because I was kind of afraid that, or afraid, I was kind of guessing that Ridley Scott would explain away the plagues.
Right.
Completely.
Yeah.
And so I was really impressed, and I think it was really cool to see them explained in a semi-natural way that had an undeniable supernatural underpinning to it.
Well, a bunch of, you know, just monstrous alligators.
Yeah.
Crocodiles wiggling around. Probably. Causing the flow of this river blood. Mm-hmm. You know, that was pretty cool.
It was cool. Yeah, it was all right. I've never seen that before.
I think my favorite part of this movie should have been when the little assistant to the priestess was doing the thing.
Right.
I was like, oh God, please let a crocodile,
eat them. I was thinking the same thing. Like,
oh, you wanted him to deep blue see him?
Well, yes. Yeah, exactly. She's out in the water pouring that thing. Like, that would have been great.
Yeah,
I thought when the magician scientist guy is running through the natural explanations,
yeah,
and then he gets hanged, I was like, what a what a fascinating critique of like a strict materialism. Right. You know, yeah. They're like, come on, man. Like, even people who want to believe you, like, gave up.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that I was like, that was one of the places like, oh, they went there. All right. Like,
yeah,
that's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. You know, undeniable. Like, even if you were wanting to buy it, still yeah. couldn't buy it. It was so undeniable.
Yeah, which is why, again,
well, you know, Mikey, part. Denial is a huge thing in Egypt.
Oh, no.
Oh, man.
Oh, no.
Oh,
man.
Oh, sorry.
Oh,
I'm done.
If this was a classier podcast, that would be the name.
If I was in China, that would be illegal now.
I say, if you were in Korea, we would have never
North
seen this
Korea.
Movie. Yeah.
Timely.
Too soon?
Timely.
Too soon?
Maybe.
Too soon? Well, okay, so we digress and wrap up.
Hmm.
Alan, do you have any final thoughts? Maybe something we missed, or something that you wanted to hit, or, you know, I think we've all kind of given our pseudo recommendations, but you can give your recommendation.
I just want to maybe again lobby that this is an unbelievable tool for a believing person to explain the great drama of Scripture and the great story of God with a well done, visually stunning, I think for the most part, well acted movie. Like this is a treasure mine
mm-hmm.
of opportunity. And that's what I lament when I read
the reviews
yeah. from Christians who just rip this because it's unbiblical, semi ungodly, and, you know, even in some parts, not the most exciting movie. You know, like, gosh, everything that the culture would say or could say about God, they've said it in this movie, and yet at the very end God is vindicated. So I just love that. I love the movie. I won't go see it again, but I love the opportunity that it presents.
Cool.
Yeah, I think the way I would want to say what I was trying to say earlier is the image of God that we find in the film is not made up out of whole cloth.
No.
It's well founded in the Scriptures, and if mm-hmm. if you don't admit that, you're not reading the Scriptures honestly, and no one who is not a person of faith is going to take you seriously when you try to have a spiritual conversation. So I like the way you said it, Alan. Like, this is a really good tool to engage that.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like, I just really don't see what they're talking about, you'll see it in Exodus. Like,
yep. yeah,
you will. And yep. yeah, that's not the final word. Christians who take that problem in the text seriously don't come to the conclusion that God is a capricious, immature deity who had to grow up and take some Xanax and have a kid before he could love everyone.
Right. So
don't be afraid of that, but you have to intellectually, honestly address that.
Deal with
and,
it. Yeah.
And this is, like you said, it's a great tool to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. And, you know, people have asked me, like, my thoughts on the film, and I usually describe it as most people's problems are going to be that it's not strict to the biblical text, whether, you know, you're ready, you're reading it from the Torah or, you know, in the right. context of whatever. But the problems that I do have with the film are not as much blasphemous as they are, you know, it's just slow at
right.
times.
Yeah.
Which is odd because I think we all thought it was pretty slow, but we'd be willing to watch the 4-hour version.
I would watch the 4-hour version if they tell more story.
Yeah, if we really had
more
some
character development
and yep. we really understood why people were doing it, and maybe there would be a little more focus on things like Joshua or
right.
Israel in general.
Yeah.
Which is, like I said, is something that I really like from that JR pointed out about, you know, they this is a story about Israel and we got very little about Israel.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to talk about this film. I don't necessarily think that you're going to get lots of non-Christians going to see this film.
No.
So I don't think it's going to be a great tool in the context of, my non-Christian friends went to see this. Now I'm going to tell them the truth.
Right.
But I think it's a great, I think the point that you made, Alan, is really great, because when we go see it as Christians, this is what the world thinks of our God.
Exactly.
And if you want to understand how to relate or how to talk to, how to engage with non-Christians or with people who have no faith in anything,
right,
this basically gives you all a lot of the arguments that, they give you.
Yeah.
So, you know, watch it with your eyes open, with, you know, don't disengage your mind. Don't run from this film.
Right.
I probably will hopefully not need to watch it again, unless, of course, again, you know, asterisk the 4-hour version. But I definitely think it does have some things that are worthwhile.
Yeah.
Even if my wife thought it was the most boring film she's ever seen.
I can recommend a few more boring films if she needs.
Yeah.
Yes, me too.
But as always, I'm incredibly thrilled that two men of such quality would be on this show to talk about this movie. So I want other people of similar quality to be able to connect their qualities to your qualities, and y'all just have quality everywhere. I feel I might have taken that overboard.
Oh.
So anyway, so Alan, how can people follow you? I think you've actually created a Twitter account.
Yeah.
Like, that's
keep,
not going to
keep anywhere. Alan walking, and I'm taking a beating over it. So I'm the pastor of a church in Greensboro, Church of the Redeemer. And just really
love... You're
my love...
spiritual grandfather, right?
No, the Anglicans. No, we were bad. So we were bad a long time ago. We're making a comeback. So that's probably the greatest joy of my vocational reality, is I get to serve in a church and serve with great people. And so Church of the Redeemer, RedeemerGammaSallyOscar.org is our website.
Nice. So JR, is there anything that you do on the internet that people could,
every now
could
and
check
again.
Out?
I blog at NorvalRogers.com. That's with two L's. And I also, that's where you can find the review of Exodus Gods and Kings that Mikey referenced a couple times. I also have a couple of podcasts, The Story Men, which actually the episode we're putting out should be out by the time you hear this, is with a rabbi where we talk about Exodus also. And then I also have one called Origami Elephants with a friend of mine named Bryn, who is agnostic. And we just talk about things that people usually fight about, and we try to be friends instead. So.
Sweet.
If you listen to the Baylor panel, Bryn, who's my Origami Elephants co-host, and Clay, who's one of the story men, were on that with Mikey and me. So if you liked that, we like those podcasts. And then I'm on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all those places.
Yeah, and I'll put all that, those web links, those show, those Twitter handles, you know, so we can keep Alan walking, et cetera.
I just followed him on Twitter.
Yay!
Yep.
So maybe
you
in a
and
month,
like 50 other people.
I can say
no,
maybe
it's
a month.
More than that!
He's a popular guy. No. The Reverend
Cannon. Alan, you have more than average Twitter followers.
Okay, well.
Just so you know.
I'm shooting for the stars, more than average.
Well, you're already above average, so you're above
But yeah, well, I'll have all that stuff, all the ways to get a hold of these guys, all the way to follow what they're doing, things they're involved in, at realworldtheology.com. You can follow me at Physification on Twitter, or you can follow the show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more, like I said, go to realworldtheology.com. It's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. You'll find this episode, other episodes, lots of reviews. We put out a written review of some of our first thoughts about Exodus. If you're into that, reading that when you don't have time to listen to the whole show, but you've already listened to this whole show, so you might as well listen to all the other whole shows because reasons. So connect with us on Facebook.
Rate it on iTunes.
Yeah, rate it on iTunes. Find us on iTunes. Find us on Stitcher. You know, just rate the show. We, like I said, it's Christmas time, so give us your 5-star reviews. That's the gift that keeps on giving.
Give us
you know?
The gift of time and positive words.
That's right. You know, if you have negative feedback, don't put that on iTunes. Just don't listen to the show anymore and whatever. Anyway, but I mean, that's even possible, because how could you not love the show?
How could you not?
But I just want to thank my guests for being here. So thank you, Alan. Thank you, JR,
absolutely.
So much.
Our pleasure.
Great to meet you, JR.
Likewise.
And now, you know, everyone's made a new friend. And hopefully you, the listeners, also have enjoyed it. So thank you for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, I hope that everyone has a very... Merry Christmas or Happy Holiday, whatever it suits you. And please remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Adios.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
Identifying the problem, what is it? Charles W. Kettering, who invented the catalytic converter and is a native Daytonian, said that a problem well defined is a problem half solved.
Well, there you go.
So
there you go.